This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Yesterday we heard from Larry Flynt, whose pornography empire and First Amendment battles are the subjects of the new film The People vs. Larry Flynt. The film is directed by Milos Forman. In the introduction to Flynt's new memoir, Forman writes that he doesn't like pornography, but he believes in freedom of expression. Forman grew up in Czechoslovakia, when freedom of expression was suppressed first by the Nazis and then by the communists. On this archive edition, we have a 1994 interview with Forman discussing that period of his life. Forman began his film career working under the communist bureaucracy in Czechoslovakia. His Czech movie Fireman's Ball played at the New York Film Festival in 1967 and was his ticket to the U.S. His American movies include One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, Hair, Ragtime, Amadeus, and Valmont. Forman was a child during World War II when the Gestapo was in charge. After the war in 1948, the communists took over. Both of Forman's parents died in Nazi death camps. His father was on the fringes of the underground. One of the Nazis responsible for the death of Forman's parents had been one of their employees years before.
My parents built a very small 15-room pension, or little hotel, if you want, in former Sudetenland, which was the part of Czechoslovakia which was taken over by the Nazis first, by the Germans first. And as a kind of a foreman on the building of this pension in 1920-something, I was not even born, was a German citizen there. And I know that my parents were very fair people and they treated him fairly. But when the Nazi came to power, suddenly this man, of course, was somehow humiliated that he worked for some Czechs, which is, you know, not a race or nation, which is, you know, up to the Nazi or German stature. And by sheer coincidence, this man ended up in the Gestapo in Kolín, which was the town under which Czaslav, a little town in the middle of Bohemia, was under. And when he got all these names, and he saw the names of my parents, first my father and then my mother, he just stamped the paper with a stamp which said the return undesirable. And that's it. And then they perished.
Your mother was taken by the Gestapo after they came to search your house. What was it like? You were, I think, 7 years old or something?
8 years. With mother, I was 8 and a half. Yeah, I was 8 and a half years old. I was sick that day, and I was. I had a fever, I had a flu, I was in bed, and I heard, you know, that some voices downstairs, because we were living in a little house, you know, one-story house in Czaslav, and for a long time, and I knew that something is strange, because I heard that strange noises from downstairs, and then I hear steps coming upstairs, and then the door open a crack, and my mother is there, and she's handing me a cup of water and a pill, and says, now take the pill, and I said, but I shouldn't be taking the pill until the afternoon. The Gestapo is here. And she just gave me that. So I took the pill and I, you know, the door closed. I saw a man standing behind her there. And then I realized why she's telling me that, because I was, my bedroom was a tiny little room behind which was another tiny little room to which the door were covered by a cupboard. And to keep the fresh air in, the cupboard was always a little bit away from the door. And I realized that she wants me to push the cupboard back to the wall so that it covers the door. And when they come to my bedroom for search, that they will not find it. But I was too weak, and the cupboard was oak wood and very, very heavy. I took all the things out, and I was trying to push it back, and I didn't succeed. That was the most horrible feeling, because I felt like I failed my family. The irony is that then when they came in and found out, you know, this other room there, they went in, they looked around, they went out, they were even smiling at me. And then they went down again with my mother. But then I hear the door click, and then there was silence. And this was, you know, they came like 8 o'clock in the morning, and this was like 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And there was silence. And I hear the car going away from in the street, and there is a total silence. They just didn't even let my mother go upstairs and say goodbye. And I am alone, absolutely alone in the whole house. And there was nobody in the town of Czaslaw, you know, who would come home.
So what was it like for you to go through the rest of the war without parents?
Well, that's another big paradox. You know, a child doesn't really perceive the tragedy like that. Especially, you know, I probably would be much more stricken by grief if my parents died yesterday than when they died when I was a child. And because child doesn't really perceive the finality of life. The death is, especially in these cases, because they were away. They were somewhere.
Right, you didn't know they were going to die.
So you don't know they are going to die. They are somewhere. And then one day, somebody tells you, in this case it was my uncle, told me, listen, my sister, your mother died. But in my daily life, nothing changed. You know.
So you had family, extended family to bring you up, uncle?
Oh, my relatives were taking care of me, yes.
I want you to recall a specific day during the war, and this is a day that must have had special significance for you. It's the day that the Germans decreed that all the art houses had to close, the theater, the ballet, the orchestra, the movies. Were you already interested in the arts when that happened?
I was very much. Well, not interested. I was seduced because I was a child again. You know, I was 10 years old or 11 years old. And my brother, who is 12 years older than I am, he was like 23 years old. He was a set designer for a traveling small group, theater group company, which was playing operettas. And every time when they came to town where I was living with my relatives, you know, I was backstage. And, you know, I was just mesmerized by the atmosphere of the theater. And because I was a little kid, you know, nobody kicked me out from the ladies' dressing room, right? So that was very, very exciting. And then, I didn't know anything, why it's happening. It was the most weird experience because I remember very well, Polish Blood is the name of the operetta. It's a very fluffy, light operetta. And this was 1944. And suddenly in the third act, during a very merry kind of a song, it was like a quartet or a quintet, and the ballet dancers and things on the stage, suddenly the singers stopped singing and started to cry, tears running down. And the orchestra stopped, conductor stopped. The people in the theater were sitting silently, quietly. Nobody was sort of upset or surprised. I just didn't know what's happening. Then the conductor tried to start the aria or the quintet again. They started to try to sing again this very merry, happy song. And again, in the middle of the song, they broke down and in tears and cried. And then the man came on the stage and said, ladies and gentlemen, I hope you understand the emotional state of the artist who will not be able to finish the performance today. Thank you for coming. It was so nice. Good night. And the curtain went down, and that was the end of culture. Because I didn't know that the day before, the Germans just canceled culture. The next day, every single singer, every single dancer, every single musician had to go and enlist himself or herself in a factories to work for the victory of the Third Reich.
My guest is film director Miloš Forman. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back to our 1994 interview with Miloš Forman. He directed the new movie, The People vs. Larry Flint. Let me skip ahead to a few years after World War II, when the communists took over Czechoslovakia. Do you have specific memories of that?
I remember that, you know, it's, again, very, very strange thing to realize. I remember I was in the boarding school, and I was in the fifth grade, and of the gymnasium, which was, you know. And we were traveling from the school in the nature, from the mountains, and when we were standing and waiting for another train on the train station in Mladá Boleslav, where from the loudspeakers is coming a speech by the president, then you know, Communist Party chairman Gottwald, announcing that the communists took over the country. We just, you know, before we had any time to absorb the propaganda of this evasive social justice which the communists based their propaganda on, we didn't have time to be influenced by it. So when we heard this speech, we realized that this is totally hypocritical, you know, and unreal.
Were there things that you liked to do as a boy that you couldn't do after the communists took over because it was too bourgeois?
I never thought about these kind of things. You know, you adjust, especially in the communist society, because there are no alternatives. You mm-hmm. know, it's you are told what you can do, what you can't do, and if you don't want to do what you can do, you are not allowed to do anything. So you adjust, you know, you just accept the limitations imposed on you.
You ended up trying to go to theater school. You were rejected from theater school and ended up in film school, which I suppose was really lucky.
Well, for me, definitely.
Lucky break, yeah. Had you seen a lot of movies growing up?
Oh, yeah, in the film school. It was another paradox of communist society, because it was the best school I could ever be going into, because after the communists took over, they purged from public life the best writers, the best filmmakers, the best artists in the country, because they were not enough in creating in the vein of socialist realism for them. So they purged them, but they couldn't kill them. They had to give them some chance to make a living, so make a meager living in teaching. They were not allowed to publish anything publicly, to books or make movies or work in the theater, but they were allowed to gain meager salary as professors. So the result was that at the film school we had the best minds, the greatest artists, which were teaching us, which we could talk to.
Milan Kundera
was one of them.
Yeah, wrote Unbearable Lightness of Being was one of your teachers.
Yes, Book of Laughter and Forgetting, The Joke, you know, wonderful books.
One of the things that you did, I think this was while you were in film school or just afterwards, you hosted what you describe as a sort of Czech socialist realist Thursday night at the movies show on TV. So what was the show like? What made it the social realist version?
Well, the social realist version was that, first of all, the paranoia and of the communists to control every word which goes to the public. And television was only live. In that time, there was not Ampex and or tapes at all. So it had to be live. So but they had to control everything. So you had to write everything down, learn it by heart, word by word. The censor was sitting somewhere watching you, checking if you are saying exactly the words which you had to send the text to the office, to the Bureau of Censors. They had to put a stamp on it, send it back to you, eventually make some corrections, you know. Then you had to learn it by heart, and then they were checking if you are saying it exactly, which was sometimes absolutely ridiculous, because you are sort of, I was doing it like a improvised, like a live dialogue, conversation with somebody.
So what would you say to introduce a film? Do you remember any of the introductions you did?
All the introductions had to, you know, I was always trying to show on the television films which had some, you know, which were not just the propaganda films, but then, of course, that you had to present them in the way which the communists would accept. If it was film from France, for example, if, Children of Paradise, beautiful, romantic film, but you had to stress that this film is showing the cruelty of bourgeoisie, how it's suppressing the working class people, you know.
Did you believe any of that?
Of course not.
But you learned to say it.
Well, you say it because, you know, it's because everybody knew it's nonsense. It's
right.
A game. It's
right.
A game, you know.
When you started writing and directing movies, did you have to avoid what government officials would have defined as bourgeois subject matter?
Well, that was something else. When you do the movies, you know, I tried not to speculate what would please them. And I was lucky, because for some reasons, they think, you know, my first films were comedies, basically, in films in Czechoslovakia. And they perceive comedies as something not as important, something light, you know, make it, yeah, it's just funny, you know, it's just like that. So I was able to do these films very much the way I wanted to do them.
One of the best known of your Czechoslovakian films was Fireman's Ball. And this was a comedy. And in the version that's in circulation now, I don't know when you put this part in. I mean, I know you put it in the late 60s. The film opens with you in front of the camera explaining that, first of all, Fireman's Ball was released just before the Dubček leadership took over, and that the film had a very surprising reaction. 40,000 firemen resigned in protest against this film.
Well, they were ordered to resign. This film was banned. This film was banned right away when it was finished, and was banned, officially written for eternity.
No, why was it banned? You said comedies weren't considered as dangerous. Is this a comedy?
Well, they thought it's a metaphor on the Politburo and the Communist Party, you know, that Fireman's Ball Committee, right? That it's a metaphor for the whole leadership of the country, so they banned the film. No, no, for the, you know, that was orchestrated by the government people, this strike or the threat of practically all the volunteer firemen in the whole country to because they needed, you know, the people were so apathetic already, you know, they didn't give a damn. But of course, if the people read in the newspapers that, oh, well, tomorrow, if your house is on fire, just say, give the house goodbye, because the firemen are on strike, rightly, because they are upset about this film. So, you know, that turns people's anger against the artists, against the films, filmmakers, you know.
Were there any fires that you were accused of being personally responsible for? And did you feel responsible for any of it?
No. They didn't go on strike.
Oh, they didn't really go on strike.
They provoked this threat so that the government can say that they have a right to ban the film. So when the government banned the film, the firemen said, all right, so now we know that.
Director Miloš Forman is my guest. Now, where were you when the Soviet tanks rolled into Czechoslovakia?
I was in Paris in that time. I was in Paris working on a script for my first American movie. And that's where I learned about it.
And your family was still in Czechoslovakia?
My family was still there, but my French friends, Claude Berry and Paul Rassam, drove in car, which they borrowed from François Truffaut, to Prague to bring my wife and my children out. It was such a, you know, ridiculously, absurdly funny story, you know, because they crossed the, when they, everything was fine, but when they crossed the border, the Czech population, when the Russian army, you know, was occupying the country, just to confuse the Russians. So they either turned down or turned around all the street signs, all the signs on the roads, on the crossroads and everything. So they, you know, there was no way so that the Russians are confused and couldn't find anything. And it really took, you know, several weeks before they found some places of their interest. So when Claude Berry and Paul Rassam crossed the border going to Prague, suddenly they found themselves, you know, driving around and around, seeing deja vu places because all the, you know, signs on the roads were wrong. When they realized that they, you know, stopped, tried to stop some people, you know, and finally they stopped the motorcyclist who said, oh, yeah, I'm going to Prague, just follow me. And he started to drive. So they are now driving, following this motorcyclist. And in the middle of, you know, this wild ride through the countryside, the Pole suddenly had an urge to take a leak, right? So he said to Claude, stop, I have to take a leak. What do you mean to stop? You know, I stop and, you know, we'll lose him, we'll never find Prague. Well, what was this? Well, just open the window, roll around, you know, do it out of the window. So he climbed into the back seat of the car, and when he's doing it out of the rear window of the car, suddenly a colony of Russian tanks is coming against, you know. And they, you know, see, they could take this as a provocation. So Claude, by driving the car, you know, the car just grabbed, you know, Paul and just, you know, pulled him back into the car, and you know, he just sprinkled all over the François Truffaut's new Daimler, you know, car. And but then finally they reached Prague, and they brought my wife and my children out.
Milos Forman, recorded in 1994, he directed the new movie, The People vs. Larry Flint. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.